Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, a weekly think tank on how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz and Upstart Radio Online.
10,000 craters where it all should be. Whoa, whoa. No need to put your words in my mouth.
Welcome to the 19th episode of Third Paradigm. Our title this week is The Nature of Reality and the Plan. This comes from the Gnostic Gospel, the Sophia of Jesus Christ. In it, the post-resurrection Jesus laughs by way of introduction and then asks the disciples what they're searching for. Quick on his feet, Philip replies, "For the underlying reality of the universe and the plan." Philip has succinctly stated the two most essential questions, neither of which can be asked alone. A plan for social change is only as effective as its grasp of reality. Likewise, metaphysical musings without a plan to address suffering are an exercise in vanity. Theology and social change are two feet of the same body. Without alternating, either one will go in circles. If religion were a sassy teenager, it would be telling us to get real. The word metanoia comes up again and again in Christian scriptures. Meta, of course, is everything, the big picture, reality outside the frame. Noia is knowing from the inside out. So the word metanoia means to change your way of seeing everything. Shift into another dimension. Unfortunately, this complex word has been translated as repentance in the New Testament. Repentance means you adjust yourself to fit the world. Metanoia challenges the world by reading your own experience directly to understand the author. It doesn't presume to know anyone else's reality or to impose its understanding as rules on others. As Salman Rushdie said, "Throughout history, the apostles of purity, those who have claimed to possess a total explanation, have wrought havoc among mere mixed-up human beings." Last week, again thanks to Capitola Book Cafe, I had the chance to interview a writer and visionary who takes metanoia to a new level. He's both cracking open reality and doing better than coming up with a plan. He's creating a community vortex to invite everyone into the planning process. Daniel Pinchbeck is the author of Breaking Open the Head, 2012 The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and most recently, Towards 2012, Perspectives on the Next Age. Edited with Ken Jordan, these are essays on transformation selected from the e-zine Reality Sandwich. They write, "Our subjects run the gamut from sustainability to shamanism, alternate realities to alternative energy, remixing media to reimagining community, holistic healing techniques to the promise and perils of new technologies." The introduction ends with this injunction. Some Native American prophecies talk about this era as the time of dreaming the world awake. So let's wake up together and dream. When we come back, we'll look at some you may say are only dreamers and why they're not the only ones. But first we'll read two poems. The music is Lost Roads by Bill Laswell from his CD Hear No Evil. Notice. This evening, the sturdy Levi's I wore every day for over a year, and which seemed to the end in perfect condition, suddenly tore. How or why, I don't know, but there it was, a big rip at the crotch. A month ago, my friend Nick walked off a racquetball court, showered, got into his street clothes, and halfway home, collapsed and died. Take heed, you who read this, and drop to your knees now and again, like the poet Christopher Smart. and kiss the earth, and be joyful, and make much of your time, and be kindly to everyone, even to those who do not deserve it. For although you may not believe it will happen, you too will one day be gone. I, whose Levi's ripped at the crotch for no reason, assure you that such is the case. Pass it on. That's Steve Cowett from the Dumbbell Nebula. The Last Rites of the Bokanonist Faith. God made mud. God got lonesome. So God said to some of the mud, "Sit up. See all that I've made," said God. "The hills, the sea, the sky, the stars. And I was some of the mud that got to sit up and look around. Lucky me. Lucky mud. I, mud, sat up and saw what a nice job God had done. Nice going, God. Nobody but you could have done it, God. I certainly couldn't have. I feel very unimportant compared to you. The only way I can feel the least bit important is to think of all the mud that didn't even get to sit up and look around. I got so much, and most mud got so little. Thank you for the honor. Now mud lies down again and goes to sleep. What memories for mud to have. What interesting other kinds of sitting up mud I met. I loved everything I saw. Good night." That was Notice by Steve Cowett and Kurt Vonnegut's Last Rites of the Bokanonist Faith. The music has been Bill Laswell with Lost Roads. When my friend Joe sent out Steve Cowett's notice to his list, he included a photo of a man in a hood walking past a large storefront sign that reads, "Casket City." Kurt Vonnegut's Last Rites of the Bokanonist Faith is from his book, Cat's Cradle. Joe says that he wants this poem as his eulogy when his sons pack his ashes and those of his dearly departed Australian shepherd into some nice pyrotechnics and shoot them off over Seattle. Around my dinner table the other night, we were having another macabre conversation about the guy who was text messaging his would-be rescuers when he froze to death. We got to discussing what each of our last will and text message would be. Tom's was, "Remember to turn off the lights." Me, "Now it's your job to save the world." Olivia, "This doesn't mean you can wear my clothes." Speaking of text messaging, dailygood.org tells me that a diocese in Italy has called for digital abstinence for Lent, with texting-free Fridays. Rather than the old argument that sacrifice is good for the soul, or you should offer it up for the poor souls in purgatory, their website points out that 80% of the mineral coltan, the metallic ore used in every cell phone, DVD player, and laptop, is mined in the Congo. The diocese boldly confirms that the extraction and trade of coltan by Western industry has helped fuel the 4 million deaths in the last decade. I'm long past losing my religion, but if they keep this up, I may become a born-again Catholic. However, the Pope's no Luddite. Benedict XVI has praised Facebook and MySpace for forging friendships and understanding. We'll go to break, and when we return, we'll examine my faux pas or Freudian slip in last week's poem. We'll be right back.
distance in your eyes. I know I've said too much. I set it up. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spot.
That was REM, of course, with Losing My Religion. Skipping between religions, we'll go now from the Pope to the Buddha. Last week, when I read the Duhamel poem about Buddhist Barbie, I misspoke the Buddha's last name. Instead of Gautama, I said Guantanamo. That morning, I just read the Mark Danner report on Voices from the Black Sites, which is his article in the New York Review of Books. He's written an exposé from the International Committee of the Red Cross interviews of 14 high-value detainees in CIA custody. This had been given to the administration in February 2007, but was withheld from the public. His article starts with the first Al-Qaeda suspect, who's critically injured in his capture, but saved in order to be tortured. For 2 to 3 weeks, he's shackled naked to a chair with no solid food in an over-air-conditioned room where loud music is blasted every 15 minutes and cold water is sprayed in his face if he falls asleep. This degenerates to his head being smashed repeatedly against a wall lined with plywood. He's then placed in a coffin-like box for an indeterminate time. When brought out, this is repeated, but he's then put in a box too small to sit upright. This aggravates the sores from weeks of being shackled to a chair and opens the wounds in his stomach and leg during his capture. Finally, released and dragged from the box, he's strapped down against his wounds and waterboarded, then placed back in the tall box, then taken out and smashed against the wall. This treatment is repeated again and again. The same testimony with variations is given by the other 13 prisoners, none of whom were able to talk with each other before they gave their report to the Red Cross. One of the worst abuses is shackling their hands above their heads to force them to stand in their cells, in one case for a solid month. Sometimes they stood for hours on tiptoe, naked in a crowd of 13 male and female interrogators and brave masked muscle guys who would punch them, handcuffed and defenseless. Forced standing is used on one man with a prosthetic leg, which is taken away to make it more excruciating. Doctors and psychologists abound, measuring the swelling of their ankles, treating the cuts the shackles make on their wrists when they fall asleep, and taking their pulse during waterboarding. This adds a surreal element to the hypocritic oath spelling in context. Did anyone see the Polanski film, Death and the Maiden, with Sigourney Weaver? The doctor that she believed supervised her torture ends up in her power through a twist of fate. Even more than the torturers, she says, his presence was a betrayal of the decency and trust inherent in the role. Is it not the same for our hard-sight doctors and psychologists? Reading this online last week before my show was all pretty heavy. After so many weighty episodes, I was trying to be a little lighter, with Buddhist Barbies and Sex in the City. But it seems that the truth was determined to slip in through a slip of the tongue, changing Siddhartha Gautama to Guantanamo. But I feel certain that the Buddha would understand and approve. We'll break with Please Forgive Me by David Gray. Then we'll return to 2012 and the plan for engagement and community to change this metastasized unreality to metanoia.
Please forgive me if I act a little strange, for I know not what I do. Feels like lightning running through my veins every time I look at you. Every time I look at you. Help me out here, all my words are falling short. There's so much I want to say. Want to tell you just how good it feels when you look at me that way. When you look at me that way. Stone and watch the ripples flow, moving out across the bay like a stone. I fall into your eyes, deep into that mystery. Deep into some mystery.
That was David Gray with Please Forgive Me from his CD White Ladder. Well, the website Reality Sandwich is building a ladder too, to a 2012 consciousness breakthrough. According to the Mayan calendar, 2012 is the end of an era, if not the end of time. It's seen by some as a doomsday deadline. But Daniel Pinchbeck and Ken Jordan are actively goosing evolution to make it jump. Their anthology of transformative essays is called Toward Through 2012, Perspectives on the Next Age. My interview with Daniel will follow this episode and can be found in the Third Paradigm archives at radioforall.net. In it, we talk about some of the mystical essays, the Gnostic concept of apocalypse, and the binary nature of Native American metaphysics. In this section, however, I'd like to talk about the pragmatic essays, in the section called Community that ends the book. The first essay in this section is on the Transition Town movement. Its origins are in the raised beds of permaculture, in a film about Cuba called The Power of Community, and in the preserving of knowledge from elders called The Great Reskilling. A major focus is an energy descent action plan. Meetings are often in the open space format, whose three organizing principles have become my mantra. Number one, whoever shows up are the right people. Number two, whenever it starts is the right time. And number three, when it's over, it's over. My Monday study group, called Economics as if Human Needs Mattered, is through Transition Santa Cruz. which is at transitionsc.org. I'm also part of their local food group, which met yesterday. Rebecca Thistlethwaite of TLC Ranch presented some in-depth research about our county food shed. For one thing, of the whopping $5 billion we taxpayers gave out in 2007 farm subsidies, our county scored only 40,000 of it back. Only five crops are eligible for subsidies: wheat, cotton, soy, rice, and corn. 2007 was a banner year for staple crops, thanks to the global food crisis our economic and trade policies have imposed. Taxpayers subsidize these crops, then buy them back and pay the shipping cartels to dump them on other countries as aid. This destroys local food production and fleeces us at the same time. Now that's market efficiency. Back to Santa Cruz, from 2002 to 2007, the number of farms went down 10%, but the amount of acreage farmed declined by 28%. Currently, we have 682 farms averaging 70 acres each, as opposed to the 1,000-plus acre average of our ranching neighbors, Monterey and San Benito counties. 89 of our farms are certified organic, grossing $16 million in sales from the $447 million total. 27% of farm owners are women. 70% of our farms make less than 100K. We're number one in the country in Brussels sprout production and number seven in lettuce. We have zero dairies now that county regulations forced Claravale to move to San Benito. But bees are our top livestock, with more colonies than we have ponies, and far more useful. But horses are still number five in commodity sales. The next essay in 2012 is about urban homesteading. The author writes about building a raccoon-proof chicken Guantanamo and about guerrilla gardening and seed bombs. Serendipitously, the organizer of the Santa Cruz Homesteader Movement was at the local food meeting, but we ran out of time for Skip to present. I've been interested in his group for a while, which includes micro-livestock, seed-keeping, backyard orchards, beekeeping, scavenging, and soap-making. His group can be found online at www.meetup.com/Santa-Cruz-Sustainable-Living. Another essay traces our debt-engendered monetary system back to Sumerian economics. Now that money has been unhinged from the messy materiality of commodity currencies, it can compound infinitely. I never realized that the fiat in fiat currency translated to let it be. How royal can you get? Ben Franklin says that money begets money, but the author points out that money is inanimate. Therefore, he concludes that money must be the sexuality of the dead. But my favorite essay was on Twitter telepathy. Jennifer Palmer writes about Twitter messages of hope and resiliency that come at just the right time and match what's happening in your thoughts. She writes, "It's amazing how Twitter quickens the feedback loop between our interior selves and the universe outside us. What we send out through Twitter often returns to us in unexpected ways, as if perfectly synchronized by an invisible hand. I don't know how it works exactly, but it's similar to the way a DJ reads the vibe of a crowd and responds with the track that manages to hit each individual like a deliciously distorted echo of his or her own voice, saying everything that needed to be heard. How could the DJ know what it was that I was feeling, you wonder? Twitter telepathy creates the same complicated connections between members of ungroups, which makes it seem like magic." In the final essay, Ken Jordan writes about a meeting of high-level internet engineers and environmental activists to strategize a green online democracy. The footnote says that the first meeting happened in Ben Lomond, California, organized by Elizabeth Thompson. I have a feeling that this is the same Elizabeth Thompson who regularly sends out invitations to Green Drinks Cool Ideas our own environmental think tank. Just another bit of synchronistic magic. Our final song is the dance mix of Send Your Love by Sting. I have one more anecdote to bring this full circle. Sting's memoirs, entitled Broken Music, begins with his experience of ayahuasca, which I know I'm mispronouncing. This vision-inducing ancient medicine figures largely in Daniel Pinchbeck's books. But that wasn't the association I meant. At one point in the book, Sting writes about his manager's father, who's a Middle East CIA operative, when the Dead Sea Scrolls are found and sent to the office in Damascus. They take them up to the rooftop to look at them where the light is better. When they unroll the first one, a strong wind picks up and blows the 2,000-year-old parchment into a million fragments. I think that those of us who overlap in the Venn diagram of Gnostic scholars versus Sting fans who've read his memoir are few and far between. So maybe my proof that the story of Jesus is a parody of the zealot Messiah was gone with the wind. But if all this 2012 synchronicity is true, it'll fly back together when the time is right. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for editing and music. And keep making those connections, because it takes a network to undermine an empire.
Send your love.
Every instance, there's no religion for the joys, the rhythm. There's no-